she repeated. No, he said, shaking his head. We do know each other, somehow. He stopped smiling, looked intently into her face, tilted his head in thought. Ruby felt a sunburst sensation in her chest. When he held out his hand, his grip was warm, satisfyingly firm. Kyle Kasperson. The name was familiar, but she couldn't place it. Ruby Wilde, she said. A cup of coffee? Someplace close? Just to find out. He smiled once more. To find out, she said, letting suspicion enter her tone. That we know each other. Why not? She asked herself. A cup of coffee was easy enough, and she had the time. She double-checked her basket. There weren't any frozen items. A flustered waitress in the diner recognized Chip Kasperson, said the coffees were on the house. He grinned across the table at Ruby, who smiled back, pretending that her heart rate hadn't just skyrocketed. The astronaut and the showgirl, Kyle said when she revealed her profession. Sounds like one of Aesop's fables. The moral being? Ruby flicked ash from the end of her cigarette. Sparks, ignition, out-of-this-world sensations. Oh, my. Indeed. He came to her show at the Tropicana, watched her perform, and she put forth more of an effort than she had in some time. Her kicks were higher, her turns crisper. When she looked back over her shoulder as a Dean Martin stand-in sang Standing on the Corner, she caught Kyle's eye and widened her smile. At the end of the show, she watched him stand to applaud, saw him encourage the rest of the audience to rise. As people recognized Chip Kasperson, they turned their applause to him. Backstage, he sat and watched wordlessly as she removed her makeup. Usually, the dressing rooms were a riot of gossip, commentary, and tales of who was winning at the gaming tables and who'd jetted to Paris with some big spender. Tonight, the showgirls were subdued, maybe a little awed by Kyle's presence. He came up behind Ruby, and while the other girls looked on enviously, he circled her body with his hands. She felt the silk of her kimono warm to his touch. She tilted her head backward until it rested against his chest, and she closed her eyes. As always after a performance, she was physically tired, but it lent her a kind of languor that helped her to relax. He put his lips next to her ear, whispered, "Please, beautiful, let's get out of here." The Sands had comped him a suite in the hotel's new 17-story tower that boasted a lucky 777 rooms. Jack and Trotter's Copa Girls performed in the Copa Room, and Sinatra and Pharoah had married at the Sands in 66. The Copa featured Sammy Davis Jr., Dinah Shore, the Everly Brothers, and more mundane events like a gin rummy tournament touted to be the richest card contest in the world. The casino also advertised widely that it had astronaut Chip Kasperson as its guest. Kyle's suite was bigger than three of the Sunglow apartments combined, with what seemed like a football field's expanse of peacock blue carpeting and white modern furniture arranged in several groupings, as if conversation circles were a regular event in such a room. Wall sconces in the shape of candelabras glowed against the pale blue walls, and vast windows followed the curve of the tower. Ruby stood looking out at the lights of the strip, and she stretched her eyes past the city's garish neon to the darkness that fell away to desert and wilderness. Kyle offered her champagne. There were half a dozen bottles chilling, gifts from well-wishers. She shook her head. Ruby wanted to do this without numbing herself. She wanted to experience what was spooling out before her in the cavernous room with the biggest bed she'd ever seen. A bed decked in white as if it were an immense virginal wedding cake. I feel as if I'm on my honeymoon, she said when he held her. She smelled a spicy aftershave, and beneath that, the antiseptic scent of Dial soap. "Let it be a honeymoon," he said. "Let this be whatever you want it to be." He bent and kissed her neck. "I'm about to go weak in the knees," she confessed, and he sat her on the edge of the bed, knelt to slip off her simple black pumps. She dressed down for Kyle, dressed in defiance of her showgirl glitz in a simple black sheath dress with a minimal string of pearls. She stood so that he could unzip her dress, and he let it fall from her to pool about her bare feet. "Good Lord," he said, stepping back to look at her in her black lace bra and panties. "Don't pretend surprise," she said, smiling. "You've seen more of me than this on stage." "It's a sight I could never grow tired of." He slipped out of his perfectly polished wingtips and unbuckled his belt. They left the bedside lamp on. She pulled down the covers, lay back on the bed in her lingerie, watching him remove his shirt, his boxer shorts. She saw a flicker of vulnerability cross his face and reached her arms up to him. He eased onto the bed beside her. "Don't get lost," he said, referring to the absurdly huge bed. But Ruby understood him on a different level. She had to stay in the room, in this bed, with this man. She would not hover up near the glitter-spangled ceiling or sit in a chair, watching at a place of safe remove. She believed a national hero wouldn't harm her. Of that she was certain. He was a patriot, a man who could be trusted. As long as you weren't his wife, that is. "What are you smiling about?" he asked, catching her expression. "Being here, with you," she covered. "Good. Very good," she said. She had only Uncle Miles to compare Kyle to, but she recognized Kyle as a gentle, self-assured lover. He took his time, worshipped her body, wasn't afraid to emit sounds of gratification. And he was just as pretty as she was, Ruby thought. The muscle, the tanned skin, the jubilantly curling chest hairs, the scent of him, of them. "Kyle," she said his name, arching her back and lifting her pelvis toward his lips and tongue. He ran his lips down the length of one of her thighs, and she trembled with pleasure. He crawled back up the length of her body, took one of her nipples into his mouth, and just barely set his teeth on her raised nipple. "Oh," she moaned. "Tell me what you like," he said, his breath warm against her cheek. Ruby fought back a tinge of panic. "What I like," she thought. Her experience to date was a mantra of pleading, "Please, make it quick, get it over with." Fleetingly, she felt sorry for herself, that she would be surprised by the concept of sex as something pleasurable. "Anything, everything," she breathed. "You're on the pill?" he asked, and she shook her head. "Diaphragm," she said, glad that months ago Vivid had told her just go get fitted for one and learn how to use it. "Already in place," she added. She was surprised when he entered her. It was not the traditionally dry, painful thing that it had been with Uncle Miles. She felt the curve of Kyle's penis hit her in precisely the right spot. He teased her, put just the tip in, withdrew, made her want to call out for more. Tip, withdrawal, tip and tease, withdrawal. It drove her crazy with want, and she pulled him to her with all the strength of her arms, said, "Stay, don't go, stay." He began to move quickly then, no longer holding back, unable to hold back. She felt her orgasm take hold of her, practically deprive her of consciousness. She didn't know if she spoke or not, if she made any sound. She simply felt her body tense, consumed with heat, felt her thoughts evaporate, felt only pure, unadulterated physical sensation. Kyle stayed inside her, still hard enough to begin moving again, to let her have another, less intense orgasm. This time, she felt her nails dig into the small of his back, and she managed to stop herself from leaving marks his wife would discover. When he pulled out, she felt a pit open inside her. She felt intense, instant loneliness. She wanted to cry into the crook of his neck, say, "Don't leave me, don't leave me, don't go." It was a sudden, unbidden, wholly physical ache of abandonment that she could not comprehend, could only feel. Ruby turned her head and buried her face in the pillow. "Where are you going?" Kyle asked, taking hold of her shoulder and tenderly rolling her to face him. "What, Ruby? What have I done?" he asked, seeing her expression. "It's nothing you've done, or not done," she said. "I don't know what it is." "But that was extraordinary," he said, kissing her. "It was," she said. "It was, Kyle."
"So what?"
"I don't know." She touched his cheek with her fingertips, ran the knuckle of her index finger along the seashell curve of his ear, thought about him splashing down into the ocean in a capsule that had traveled through blackness. "Does it have anything to do with those pearlescent scars?" he asked. Ruby blushed, fumbled for an answer she didn't have.
"You hide them well, and that can't be easy wearing only a G-string."
He waited, and when Ruby remained silent, he said, "I had a girlfriend once, before my wife." He reached for his Camels and offered her one. She shook her head.
"She used to cut herself, too,"
he said, flicking a silver lighter with the NASA emblem engraved on its polished surface. The last thing Ruby wanted to do was to explain herself. What would she say? "Kyle, it makes me feel better. It releases something, that's all I know." She'd never spoken about it to anyone, and she didn't intend to start tonight. Or rather, this morning, she thought, seeing by the bedside clock that it was after 4 a.m. "I'm sorry," he said, moving the cut glass ashtray to rest on his chest. "I shouldn't have pried." "You don't have to talk about it, not if you don't want to." He crushed the last of his cigarette and rolled to face her. "But you have to admit that I was right," he said, brushing hair from her forehead. "About us, about knowing you, about you knowing me." "Yes, you were." Ruby took his hand, turned it palm up beneath the light from the bedside lamp. "Your fingertips," she said, squeezing them between her thumb and middle finger. "They're padded."
"Padded?"
"They're not flat or stingy. They're the fingertips of a sensitive person. And see this?" she said, pointing to the small mount beneath his index finger. "This is Jupiter. It's associated with ambition, pride, leadership, and honor. And yours is well developed." He pulled his hand from hers for a moment to take a better look at his palm. "But this is what most interests me," she said, taking back his hand and squeezing the mount below his ring finger. "This is the mount of Apollo. It's associated with creativity and artistry. And this is your most developed mount."
"Meaning?" he asked.
"Well, combining that with your sensitive fingertips, I'd say you are an artist of some kind, not a man who hurtles through space." She laughed and let go of his hand. "So much for palmistry."
"Actually," he said, thoughtful, "that's my dream. I write. Mostly short stories, nothing great, but it's what I truly love."
Ruby sat up, rearranged the pillows behind her, and Kyle joined her. "That explains pearlescent," she smiled. "But stories about what? Space?" "Mostly about nature,"
Things I see when I hike or walk the seashore. Stories I see in the people I encounter.
And what do you do with your stories?
She hesitated, afraid he'd tell her he read them to his wife.
Send them to the Saturday Evening Post? Magazines like that.
I'd think they'd jump at the chance to publish something written by an astronaut.
I don't use my real name, the same way I suspect you don't use your real name.
But can I read one? Ruby asked, ignoring the hint that he wanted to know who was tucked away behind Ruby Wilde.
Not until someone actually publishes one. His disappointment was evident.
You can send me one, she said.
Don't make me wait for a magazine.
I could, he said, smiling. But in the meantime, he tickled her, and giggling, she tried to capture his fast-moving wrists.
I'm here for a week, and I intend to see a great deal of you, whatever your name is, he grinned.
How was it? Vivid began the inquisition, but the others quickly joined in.
Out of sight? Out of this world? Rose asked.
Far out, Vivid grinned.
What? Dee asked. What are you guys talking about?
You must be the only person on the face of the planet who doesn't know, Ruby said.
Know what? Dee asked again.
Only person in the solar system, Rose said.
Only one in the universe, Vivid trumped Rose.
Enough with the space jokes, Ruby said, feigning frustration.
Will somebody please tell me what's going on? Dee nearly shouted.
Ruby slept with Chip Casperson.
No.
Dee looked to Ruby for confirmation.
The astronaut?
Ruby nodded, smiling.
So, to begin where we started, Vivid said, grabbing Ruby's shoulders from behind and shaking her.
How was it?
Earth-shattering, Ruby grinned.
God, Dee said, when did all this happen?
The others dissolved into helpless laughter.
No one tells me anything, she said, pretending to pout, and then grabbing a cushion from Rose's couch and pelting Ruby.
I need details, she shouted, hitting Ruby while the others grabbed cushions and joined her.
Yeah, Vivid said. It's the least you can do for those of us who have not had intergalactic sex.
Ruby folded her hands as if she were a peaceful Buddha and began.
Okay. First of all, let me just say that he is extremely well endowed. I believe you mere earthlings would say his dimensions are astronomical.
Over the years, gamblers bought her nearly a dozen furs. Yet her all-time favorite was her first, an abundant, calf-length silver fox fur with an absolutely enormous collar she could stand up so that its softness caressed her cheeks. It was so supple that it rippled like water when she walked. The coat's lining was a hot pink China silk. And the buyer was Kyle, the day before he left Vegas to return to his suburban Ohio home. Ruby leapt into the coat in the nude, and they drove the Carmen Ghia she'd bought herself into the desert outside the city, where the darkness was so complete she could barely see her hand held before her face. They parked in a desolate spot on a forlorn dirt road, lowered the car's top, and watched as the stars faded and dawn arrived in pinks, intense peaches, and deep roses. Ruby listened to the coyotes howling and barking. She heard the whoosh of an owl's wings as it swooped to grab an unwary desert rodent. Away from the bells and whistles of the strip, its omnipresent clouds of cigarette smoke, she could smell desert sage and catch the eyes of jackrabbits in her headlights. She felt peace in the aching, lonesome stretch of desert sand. She felt at home in this inhospitable setting. And Ruby felt gratitude for the solid, real presence of Kyle as they leaned against each other, warm, easy, wordless. She felt what she knew would be an enduring fondness for him, for his tenderness, as well as his commitments that kept her from becoming attached. Kyle was a dance partner who'd helped her to disentangle herself from a sizable, dark part of her past. He'd go back to his wife, and Ruby. She would go on to others. 9. Kyle was the first, but not the last. Ruby was fondest of him by far, but their affair had lasted barely a week, and he had his squeaky clean public image to maintain. After Kyle, if the man was handsome enough, charming enough, or if he made her laugh, then and only then would Ruby consider riding the elevator with him to his hotel suite. The nearly anonymous sex was, she thought, about the best thing ever invented. It let her experiment freely. The man, whoever he was, would be gone in a few hours or days, so why not? It let her demand. It helped her to drive out the demons Uncle Miles had bred inside her, to make them matter less and less as they were caught in the undertow of other experiences, other men. Ruby had her favorite times, her favorite men and sensations. She consciously let fade the lackluster performances, the times when she'd been wrong about the chemistry or when her partner for the night had been too drunk to perform. Sometimes she could hear Aunt Tate's voice shouting, "Slut!" And she knew that most of America would have called her that, probably even her parents, had they lived. But Vegas gave Ruby the freedom to experiment, and maybe things were changing. As 1967 eased toward 1968, Ruby got up, got dressed, and left men while they slept. She left them, always. She left them and left them and left them, and she knew it was the perfect life for her. Meaningless, recreational sex allowed her to convince herself that she was somehow protected, that her heart was immune. She sent the aviator a jar of Tang, the astronaut's drink, along with a photo of the showgirl and the astronaut Chip Casperson. The aviator responded by sending her a copy of This Side of Paradise. Inside the book's cover, he wrote, "To the girl who's been to outer space." He never threatened to visit and check up on her, never mentioned her aunt and uncle, but Mrs. Baumgarten repeatedly promised visits. Her husband's busy surgery schedule always interfered, which was actually fine by Ruby. She had to admit a secret grudge against her well-meaning dance instructor, the one who hadn't given Ruby particularly informed or good advice, who'd pretended to know more than she did about Vegas and the dance world in general. Big fish, little pond. It was a saying her father had used, and Ruby thought it most apt when it came to Lenore Baumgarten. On her days off, Ruby went to see other Vegas shows, sometimes with her friends, but more often on the arm of one of the cigar-scented men who sought to charm her. At the Aladdin, she saw Tempest Storm, marveled at the woman's artful striptease, the finesse with which the Queen of Burlesque removed her clothing. At the Sahara, Ruby rubbed shoulders with Joe DiMaggio and Paul Anka, and during one of Buddy Hackett's shows in the Conga Room, she spotted Sonny and Cher in the audience, along with Michael Landon and his wife. "Eat your heart out, Uncle Miles," she thought, knowing how much he'd have given to see Bonanza's little Joe in the flesh. On Chicago Johnny's arm, she passed beneath the Riviera's twirling neon star, through the 9,000-square-foot lobby, and in the casino's Versailles room, she saw performances by Louis Armstrong, Anne Margaret, Sarah Vaughan, and Debbie Reynolds. Afraid of losing track, Ruby listed the shows and dates in the back pages of her cash book. "What are you up to?" Rose asked, entering Ruby's apartment and finding her setting up a card table. "I bought a sewing machine." Ruby struggled with the legs of the table and at last got them locked. She scooted the table beneath a living room window so she'd have plenty of natural light. "Why? I mean, you can afford to buy any clothes you want, Or have them bought for you. Ruby had often wondered how Rose felt about showgirl perks. The clothes, the jewels, and in Vivid's case, the cars and boats, and probably one day even planes. Rose kept her clothes on, and so she was earning a comparatively mediocre salary, supplemented from time to time by drunken, elated gambler largesse. Still, Ruby had never broached the subject openly. It seemed like a possible bruise for Rose, and she had no intention of pressing it. "I used to make almost all my clothes," Ruby said, lifting the sewing machine from its box and setting it on the card table with a heavy thunk.
"My point exactly, used to."
Rose began sorting through Ruby's pile of Hermes scarves with the purpose of borrowing one to wear on her date with a new man, a Caesar's card dealer. "You're wearing your linen sheath, the turquoise one?" Ruby asked, scrounging around in the cardboard box until she found the sewing machine's instruction booklet and box of accessories, including a newfangled buttonholing device. The machine was far beyond Aunt Tate's old no-frills singer. Ruby was excited, anticipating all of the things she could make.
"Yeah, the blue dress," Rose said.
"Good God, Ruby, how many of these do you have?" Ruby went to stand by Rose and sorted through the pile of silk until she found the scarf she thought would best complement Rose's dress. She unfolded it and held it up so Rose could decide. It was a pattern of greens, blues, and purples with black accents that reminded Ruby of stained glass windows.
"Perfect," Rose said, taking the scarf and carefully refolding it. "So, explain the sewing machine, please."
She sat down in one of Ruby's new wingback chairs. Ruby had had them custom upholstered in hot pinks and whites, bold geometric patterns. The Sunglow apartments, with their broad-bladed Venetian blinds and shadowy interiors, looked as though they had played a starring role in some Fred McMurray noir film, and Ruby was determined to brighten things up.
"I want to design clothes," Ruby said, opening the refrigerator and pulling out a pitcher of iced tea. "Want some?"
"You bet." "Anyway," Ruby pried up the lever on the ice tray and freed enough cubes for their glasses.
"I have this new friend, Tawny. She's one of the Tropicana's backstage seamstresses, and just so talented. I mean, I've always used patterns, been careful to follow all the instructions to a T, but she can cut and sew freeform. Just take a look at a garment and then replicate it, but with her own style. So we got to talking."
"Did you talk salary?" Rose interrupted, accepting the iced tea. "Because I can guarantee it would be a ridiculously big pay cut." Ruby, who was wearing hugely belled bell-bottom pants dyed in broad vertical stripes of white, red, yellow, and blue, plopped down sideways in the other wing-back chair. She looked down at her thigh on the pink and white upholstery and thought about how jarring the materials were. They nearly screamed, "I can't dance forever, you know."
"You're 19. That's hardly old."
"But the lifespan of a showgirl, you know," she said, hinting at what they'd all seen in Vivid, prime fading toward the beginning of the end.
"I'm just saying you're not there yet, not for years."
"Maybe not. But I'm thinking about my future. I'm thinking that maybe I could be a costume designer here in Vegas. I want to learn, and Tawny can teach me some of the fundamentals. I'm already sketching," she said, nodding toward a portfolio she'd left open on the love seat. "Just ideas I have, designs I could start with."
"That's all good," Rose said, sipping at her tea, thoughtful.
Lately, Ruby had been inspired by fashions from the 20s. From the F. Scott Fitzgerald novels The Aviator sent, and fleetingly, she wished Rose had shown some curiosity about her design drawings.
"What about you? What do you want to do after Caesars?" "I don't know why I can't do what a showgirl does, if and when I get tired of Caesars. Just move to a different casino. Change the scenery."
Vivid was on her third casino since Ruby had met her. The showgirls easily moved from stage to stage, and it kept the productions fresh to have the dancers move about. It also let a showgirl quit for a few weeks, jet someplace with some man hot off a big win, and then come back to work. Ruby shook her head.
I mean your future future, she said meaningfully. I'm talking about long-term planning, Rose.
I'm not like you. I'm more of a spur-of-the-moment gal. Besides, she said, setting her empty glass on the floor beside her chair. Isn't that what a husband's for?
Oh, please, Ruby rolled her eyes. You can do better than that.
Who says? And who says there's anything wrong with that? It could be that Matt's the one.
Tonight's Prince Charming?
Yeah.
Okay, then, Ruby said, not wanting to make her friend feel as if she were selling herself short. It had never once entered Ruby's mind that marriage, or some man, would give her the kind of security she needed. As a matter of fact, life had taught her something entirely different.
But what about you? Don't you want someone steady in your life, a true love interest?
Rose flipped her hair over her shoulder.
I mean, and I'm not judging here. It seems what you're doing could get pretty lonely after a while.
I'm not lonely.
Fine. But don't you want something more permanent, a man you could rely on?
The way I see it is, if it's meant to be, it will be.
I think literally the man who's right for me will just show up on my doorstep. I'm not into all this girly manipulation.
Rose smiled and aimed her gaze meaningfully toward Ruby's record albums. Nancy Sinatra's Nancy in London album was sitting front and center.
So, Rose said, you're gonna go with wishin' and a hopin'?
Ruby grinned.
I'm certainly not going to follow that song's advice.
You mean wearing your hair just for him, doing the things he likes to do? Rose laughed.
Lord, no,
Ruby shook her head, thinking she might have to give Nancy Sinatra a rest for a while.
I'll tell you what I really want, Rose said, now deadly serious. I want children. And stop it, don't shake your head at me.
I wasn't going to, Ruby objected.
I want to build a home, create holiday traditions, teach my daughter to roll out sugar cookie dough. I want a man who will hold my interest and give me security.
Rose paused.
But what else? Ruby asked.
You do want more than a Leave It to Beaver life, don't you?
There's nothing wrong with wholesome, says the woman who wears a teeny tiny toga to work. Says the woman who has a good job, who has gotten out to see the world, and who now has a better frame of reference. I've tested my theories.
Which are?
What's meaningful? What amounts to a life well lived?
So Vegas is your contrast, the black to your white.
Maybe.
But you and I know it's a place where a girl can come to have a life of her own before she settles down.
Look at Vivid. She has her independence, her freedom, but it can't be all she wants.
Who says?
She'll marry some tycoon.
That's not what she tells me, Ruby said. She told me she wants to be rich in her own right, not have some sugar daddy doling out gifts or making all the financial decisions.
I mean, come on, Rose. If the man has all the money, he has all the power.
Can you really see Vivid taking orders?
Rose laughed. Point made. But don't belittle my dream, all right? I'm entitled.
Rose's dream life was essentially the life Ruby had supposed her sister Dawn would have had, had she lived. Marriage, children, sunny day picnics, and rainy day baking. It's what Rose had grown up knowing, what Dawn had known, and for that reason alone it made sense. But Ruby believed that the doors that led to such acceptability, such wholesomeness, as Rose said, were closed to her. And now, given her Vegas life, Ruby was far too tainted ever to kiss the pristine garments of wholesomeness.
And what about you? Rose interrupted Ruby's thoughts. It's pretty obvious that one thing you're after is a big savings account, right? I mean, how much have you got socked away?
Almost immediately, Rose apologized.
Shit, I'm sorry. It's none of my business. It's just that you don't spend anything.
Well, practically nothing, she said, eyeing the new sewing machine.
It's because you never know.
Ruby stood to get more iced tea. You never know what life will throw at you. Rose followed Ruby
and held her glass out for a refill. Sometimes you act like you're 40. She took a sip of tea. What happened to you? I mean, to make you so cautious?
It had to be something big.
I'm not cautious. You're cautious with money.
I'm careful.
Whatever, you're avoiding the question.
I'm refining the question, Ruby smiled.
Still avoiding, Rose shot back.
Let's just say I learned early on that the rug can get pulled out from under you. Like the Boy Scouts say, be prepared.
Ruby set down her glass and put a foot up on the kitchen counter, stretched.
You're not going to tell me, Rose said.
No offense intended. Ruby paused in her stretch and looked at Rose. If I told anyone, it would be you, okay? I just don't want to relive it.
Okay, Rose said, picking up the Hermes scarf.
If you like it, keep it.
Sure you won't miss it? Rose teased, looking toward the tower of scarves.
We're going to want a full report, Ruby switched legs, in the morning, or whenever you decide to come home.
Maybe, Rose said on her way out the door.
But I can keep a secret, too.
Ruby hadn't told any of them of her family's death. She didn't want the breath of her loss to define her. And she didn't want to see anything different in the eyes of her friends. But what did her past matter anyway? She was Ruby now, not Lily. When she'd last bought a new wallet, she carefully printed the aviator's contact information on the emergency identification card and tucked it behind the plastic window. He was her family. All she wanted of family. In the spring of 1968, Evan Brashear wooed Ruby from the Tropicana to the Stardust, where she became one of Brashear's Lido Bells. Brashear was a really nice man in a city that wasn't always particularly nice, and he had pomaded, curly hair, an omnipresent cigarette holstered in his right hand, and a pointed chin that turned up slightly, reminding Ruby of the curled toe of a Turkish slipper. He gave her a hefty raise and put her on the cover of the menu for the Café Continental, the lounge where the Lido de Paris show was performed. Ruby even won Vegas Showgirl of the Year, which was a huge honor, especially for someone who'd barely been dancing 6 months.
You stand out, Brashear told her. Even in a line of girls meant to look alike, you're luminescent, Ruby Wilde.
A phenomenon, he'd said, chucking her under the chin.
Her first starring role at the Stardust was in a performance meant to feed off of audiences' fervor for anything having to do with space exploration, particularly as the launch for the moon landing mission approached. Otherworldly, tinny music began playing as the curtains opened. Suspended far above the stage on nearly invisible cables, the Lido Bells were clad only in cellophane and G-strings. Against an indigo backdrop, liberally sprinkled with flickering stars, they performed an ethereal spacewalk wearing close-cropped silver feathers meant to simulate space helmets. At the end of the number, brightly colored silk parachutes unfurled, and they descended to the stage in a Vegas version of a space capsule splashdown. The switch to the Stardust bolstered Ruby. And yet, she could no longer completely hide from herself the fact that although she'd not been dancing for even a year, tedium was stealthily encroaching. The requisite mixing with men after the show had become work. Their enamored looks had grown stale, and she was finding it harder and harder to feel sympathy for them. Instead, they reminded her of insecure little boys, when what she longed for was virility. Ruby had to drag herself to the gaming tables, muster the energy to put on a happy face, to charm and delight. Too, the novelty of applause and of the seemingly endless flood of cash, it was gone, somehow worn thin by repetition. The gaudy superficialities of the showgirl life were no longer enough to hold her. She wasn't sure where her dissatisfaction came from. She just knew it was there, tapping on her shoulder more and more insistently as the days passed. And she'd begun cutting again. Even though she tried to keep the slices beneath her G-string
and used opaque makeup to cover the scars. It was difficult to hide. She experimented with cutting the bottoms of her feet, knowing shoes would always hide the wounds, but slicing into callus didn't call forth blood, and it was the relief of blood she needed. Putting a blade to the tender skin of her arches impacted her dancing. She tried that once, only once. Ruby was certainly smart enough to know that the cutting meant something. She could almost hear the aviator shouting about her superior IQ and her ability. If she would only try to marshal her emotions and control all of this. She knew she needed to pay attention, to sit still long enough to come to terms with what caused the insistent hunger for blood and release. In some ways, it reminded her of Vivid's periodic, compulsive need to rush out and buy 10 eyeshadow compacts or 6 pairs of designer boots, sometimes even a new car. Something hidden, subterranean, gave birth to the need. Ruby knew that the cutting was a symptom, and she could no longer pretend it was a release for something Uncle Miles or Aunt Tate had done, or not done. No, this current urge to cut was the progeny of a need born in her childhood, something she desperately wanted to extinguish. Ruby had read an article in one of her Life magazines about the growing popularity of transcendental meditation in far-out California. There was something about Buddhism that called to her, even if it was simply the concept of such extreme internal quietude. So she tried navel-gazing, as Vivid called it, thinking that maybe by sitting cross-legged on her bedroom carpeting, with a lit votive candle flickering weakly on her dresser top, she'd somehow come to terms with the disease-ridden ghosts of her childhood. But Ruby could only sit for 30 seconds or less before a cacophony of thoughts interrupted. She couldn't plumb the darkness, couldn't extricate the threads that connected her past to her present. All she could fathom was that something was missing in her life, something that would drive her, thrill her, that would put an adrenaline-sharp edge to her life. If she had that, the kind of wholehearted purpose that escaping Kansas had given her, then she would be all right. Miserable and seeking relief of some kind, Ruby went to her usual fount of wisdom and asked Vivid how she'd stood the life of a showgirl for so long.
"But it's a blast! I've never been bored, not once," Vivid claimed. "I love being in good shape, feeling the beauty of my body, the power it gives me. There's no other life I want, but maybe I'm not as smart or as deep as you," she said, clearly intending to goad Ruby. "It's not that, and you know it. It's just that it's not enough for me. I think I need something more."
"Well, what exactly?"
"That's just it," Ruby said, rubbing her forehead. "I don't know."
She watched her friend pick up the red lacquer box Ruby had often admired. Vivid opened the box and held it out to Ruby. It was about 3/4 full of small white pills.
"What's that?" Ruby asked.
"Amphetamines. Speed."
"You've never tried it?"
"Never."
"I get them from this doctor. He does a crazy business for all the housewives and teenage girls who want to be skinny."
"They're weight loss pills?"
"Not meant to be, although they do keep you from being hungry.
They'll give you a boost, get you high, make you feel good so that you can get into the swing of things again. Think of them as little bits of motivation."
Vivid handed the box to Ruby to hold and plowed through a kitchen drawer until she found a roll of sandwich bags. She filled a baggie, 1/4 full, rolled the bag on itself, and then wrapped a rubber band around the cylinder.
"Start with a couple, an hour before you need them. The buzz will last about 3 hours, max, so you'll need to pick me up after the show. Take another couple then. You can always work your way up to more."
"They're not dangerous?"
"Hell no," Vivid laughed. "Half the girls in America, well, the rich ones anyway, are getting these from their good old family doctor. Their mothers drive them to the appointments."
Ruby tried them that night, following Vivid's recommended dosage, but upping it to 3 pills for sufficient inspiration to survive the after-show drudgery. She found she was better able to concentrate on whatever the men were saying, to listen more patiently, or to find something to occupy her attention, such as cufflinks shaped like dice or poker chips, scabbed over nicks from a razor, or a roll of tan neck flesh above a too-tight collar. She created contests for herself, competitions in which she had to name 6 distinct attributes about a man within the first 2 minutes of meeting him. Speed turned life's volume up, just enough. She was so wired, though, that she couldn't get to sleep until just a few hours before the next night's show, which meant that the following night she took even more. The night after that, she took more. Over the course of the next several weeks, Ruby jitterbugged her way into the life of an insomniac. All of those hours when she used to sleep, freed up, she delighted in getting all of her ironing done. Although her fingers vibrated with near electric voltage, she drew designs for everyday dresses and pantsuits, swimsuits, cocktail dresses, evening gowns, lingerie, and of course, costumes for the stage. She was getting so much done. She defrosted her freezer, she blew the dust off her record albums, and set Dylan's greatest hits to play, flipping the album over time and time again. Sometimes moving the needle repeatedly to I Want You and Positively 4th Street. Feeling hollowed out but immune to hunger, rocketing through the night into the early dawn hours, accompanied by Dylan's nasal tones, Ruby wondered what had happened to the fervor she'd felt just a few years ago. Where had she been for the past year or so? Where was her edge, the adrenaline fix of risk? Who was she anymore? Just a fungible showgirl? Was she coasting, letting her ambition wither while she distracted herself with parties and possessions? Her thoughts raced. There was a near-constant buzz in her ears, like a frenetic housefly ping-ponging, seeking exit. She'd been wasting time, wasting time. But the speed was helping her to see, to search for what she really needed. She got the speed doctor's address from Vivid. He didn't listen to her heart, weigh her, or do any of the things Ruby expected. All he asked was that she tell him that she needed to keep her weight down for the stage, and voila, she had his signature granting her over 100 tablets of electric energy. The drugstore pharmacist didn't even blink when, feeling like a girl with a forged permission slip, she handed him the prescription. The drug made her mouth taste like tinfoil. She started sucking on peppermints and red cinnamon candies to mask the metallic taste and help with what seemed to be an eternally parched mouth, no matter how much water she chugged in between numbers. She was fidgety, couldn't sit still to read, and she felt like one of the aviator's cars running in top gear, smooth, perfect, but with the engine pushed to the edges of its design for speed. Each time Ruby popped a handful of pills, she envisioned a tachometer's needle touching the red zone. She stayed up for days in a row, jotting down all the design ideas that came to her, certain that each one was brilliant, that she could outdistance any designer on the planet. Once she had the right connections and got better at the technical aspects of sketching and making real what she saw in her head, she gunned the engine of herself and raced headlong toward her future. 10. Driving to work during the first week of April, Ruby listened to the news reports. She lit a cigarette, adjusted the tuning on the radio, rolled down a window, drummed her fingers on the steering wheel, and bounced with frustration at the delay imposed by a red light. She heard it then. Martin Luther King Jr., shot dead in Memphis. By the time Ruby reached the Stardust parking lot, she was sobbing, bent in half, clutching her middle. He was 39, just 39. And all he'd wanted to do was lead a strike for poorly paid garbage workers. Could there be a worse job than picking up someone's rotting trash? Well, emptying septic tanks, maybe. Those men should be the best paid. They did something no one else wanted to do.
Imagine being married to one of those guys. The laundry. How could you ever get his shirts clean? Talk about ring around the collar.
But wait, King. She was thinking about King. She'd been following the news stories of his peaceful civil disobedience, and she'd admired him. Had even written to the aviator about Gandhi and King. This couldn't be. It just couldn't.
Ruby fumbled and then dropped her keys, got down on all fours in the parking lot to search for them beneath the car. She was crying still, loudly, messily. She stumbled up the curb, pushed her sunglasses back up on her nose, and standing next to a perfectly arranged flower bed, she took a deep breath. She couldn't work. Not today. It was the first time she'd ever considered missing a performance, but she felt helpless, caught up in the King tragedy. Ruby made her way down the hallway of administrative offices, trying not to see the garnet red carpeting beneath her feet, not to think of blood pooling beneath King's head. She was plain-faced, her gym bag whacking her hip, a baseball cap pulled over her hair. Wiping tears from her cheeks with the back of her hand, she knocked on Evan Brashear's office door.
"What's happened?"
he asked, coming out from behind his desk.
"Here."
He pointed toward his couch. "Sit down. Talk to me, Ruby." He took a handkerchief from his pocket and handed it to her.
"I can't dance, not tonight," she said.
"But what's happened? What can I do?"
"They shot him. He's standing outside his hotel room, and he gets shot."
She knew she looked awful, that her face was blotchy and red, but she didn't care. She couldn't remember the last time she'd gotten more than 2 or 3 hours of sleep.
"The Reverend King? You're talking about King?"
She nodded.
"Listen, honey," Brashear said, perching beside her and putting his arm about her shoulders. "It is a tragedy, it is. But your reaction is overblown."
He paused for a moment.
"And I think I know why. I've been watching you."
He nodded as if confirming something.
"You're not the first, and I've been at this a long, long time."
Ruby wadded his handkerchief into a ball. She took a deep, stuttering breath, felt her exhaustion. She needed to get a glass of water, down some more pills.
"You've lost a lot of weight. You have dark shadows under your eyes that are no longer hidden by that concealer you girls use."
Brashear picked up her hand, held it.
"You can't keep your hand still, not to save your life."
"I'm just a little tired."
Her legs were vibrating too, and she wondered if, seated so close to her, he could feel them.
"You're doing speed, and way too much of it."
Just enough to get me through."
"But I can't keep you on. Not if you keep this up."
Ruby felt the swift wings of panic. She couldn't be fired. It had never occurred to her that this kind man would kick her to the curb.
"Stop the pills," he said, standing to dismiss her,
a firm father determinedly gritting his teeth and laying down the law.
"You can have a few days off, but I need to see that you're serious about quitting. I know you can't do that overnight, that it will take some time, but nevertheless, next Monday, you'd better show up ready to work, looking one hell of a lot better. Convince me that you're at least trying, or I won't have a choice. Go home, get some sleep, eat. Clean up your act, Ruby."
Ruby stood, his handkerchief still a wad in her hand. She felt as if she might start crying again, and she didn't have a clue as to how to defend herself.
"It's not that I'm unsympathetic, but Ruby, you're ruining yourself. And I'm not the kind of boss who lets a girl do that."
Brashear touched her shoulder briefly and then walked back behind his desk, picked up his pack of Lucky Strikes and shook one free. Ruby stood for a moment, watching him, and then she turned and walked down the hallway until she got to the drinking fountain. She dropped 4 pills into the palm of her hand, swallowed them, and took a long drink of water, tossing her head back to make sure they went down. She shoved Brashear's handkerchief in her purse. On the drive home, while she was waiting for the drug to kick in and get her back on course, she felt increasingly angry. How could he so blithely think about dismissing her? Daddy Evan should bear in mind how much money she made the casino. He should remember who brought in the audiences and kept the gamblers hammered on expensive scotch. Who showed up at golf tournaments, kissed the cheeks of winners. Who glowed during the opening ceremonies for championship rodeos and posed for photos with every Tom, Dick, and Harry Brashear asked her to pose with. She'd even been promised the cover of the 1969 Stardust calendar. Brashear was taking her for granted. She'd just go elsewhere. She had the star power to do that. She could do it in her sleep. But first, she'd take a couple weeks off. She'd never taken a vacation, and it was high time she did. For the next 5 days, Ruby stayed glued to the television coverage of King's assassination. She watched footage of the days of rioting in Baltimore, as well as other major cities across the country. The entire nation burned with outrage, grief, and indelible hatred and bigotry. She sat cross-legged and crying, as Bobby Kennedy stood on the back of a flatbed truck in Indianapolis and encouraged forbearance. On April 9th, she watched King's funeral service at the Ebenezer Baptist Church. She ran out of Kleenex. The Sunglow apartment girls must have taken a vote. On the sixth day of Ruby's isolation, they sent Rose as their emissary. When Ruby opened the door, Rose was standing there in a sleeveless, flowered cotton shift, her hair tied back in the Hermes scarf Ruby had given her. She was holding a foil-covered pie tin, and she edged past Ruby without asking. "I'm opening the blinds," Rose said without preamble. She set the dish on Ruby's countertop and began parting curtains. "It's cold roast chicken, some cheese and pickles. Make yourself a plate of food," she ordered. Ruby looked beneath the foil, but went no further. She watched Rose find the on-off switch to the television set and silence it. "The air is stale in here," Rose said, crinkling her nose and cranking open a window. "And you." She turned, put her hands on her hips, and looked at Ruby. "You need a shower. Wash your hair, for God's sake." Ruby went and sat in one of her wing-back chairs. She sorted through the clutter of her side table, trying to find a pack of cigarettes. "What the fuck, Ruby?" Rose came to stand in front of her, took Ruby's chin in her hand, and forced Ruby to look at her. "This isn't you, this slovenliness. What the hell is going on?"
"Nothing."
"I don't have the patience for your bullshit. You've been avoiding us."
"No one asked you to come here."
"Someone had to."
"Did you draw the short stick?"
Ruby sneered, feeling awful that she was behaving so badly toward the sweetest human being on earth, and yet not having the slightest inclination to get a hold of herself. She felt supremely irritable. "Vivid didn't do you any favors," Rose said. "I know she meant well, but really, Ruby, you have to pick and choose when it comes to following her advice."
"I don't know what you mean."
Somehow, Rose was making her feel like a petulant toddler.
"You know exactly what I mean, and don't think for a moment that I'm that stupid. Please."
"Yeah, well." "Where are they?" Rose asked, looking about the disheveled living room. "Bathroom?" She headed down the hallway. Ruby could hear the door of the medicine cabinet open and close, the sound of Rose moving bottles around on the bathroom counter. She heard Rose head into the bedroom, then the thunk of the nightstand drawer opening and closing.
"Where's your purse?"
Rose said, returning to the living room. Ruby tried to kick her bag beneath her chair, but Rose spotted it and made a dive for it.
"You have no right," Ruby yelled, managing to catch hold of the shoulder strap while Rose grabbed the body of the purse and tugged.
"Have you looked in a mirror?" Rose asked. "Have you seen what you're doing to yourself? You haven't been to work in days."
"I quit," Ruby said, still clutching the purse strap. "Oh, fuck, Ruby. What's going on?"
Ruby capitulated, let go of the purse, and then, completely without warning,
She began yet another of her incessant crying jags while Rose dug through the purse and pulled out the huge glass bottle